And we are joined live in the studios by Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. And as you know, we announced last week, no job again for this week or probably another month or two. But we did want to just let you know real quickly that he did have one of the surgeries this week, and it seemed like it went pretty well, although he's in fairly significant discomfort currently. So,
The big hurdle for him isn't always the surgery. It's the post-operative recovery because of his suppressed immune system. So if everyone could just keep him in your thoughts and prayers, and we hope to see him get better.
That's right. Get him, drag him back in front of the microphone as soon as possible. Regardless of what his doctors say.
We're not putting any pressure on him, but he says that he enjoys doing the show and he misses it. So
that's right. So he misses everybody. Wants you all to know he misses you. All right. So we got plenty of local this week. First off, there was report on the homeless count was released.
Yeah, the full homeless count report was released by All Home on Friday. It was the full results, not just the summary results, which the homeless count was the one-night count of the homeless done from January 24th to January 25th of 2019, earlier this year. And they do the count during bad weather in January, because when it's cold, because it just makes it a little bit easier to do the count. People tend to go inside for shelter. It makes it a little bit easier to go around from shelter to shelter and get a head count than it does trying to find people who are camping out. Although they did find a lot of people who were camping out this year. Now, proponents of Mayor Durkan's sweep the streets approach are calling the 2019 count the first year that King County has seen a decrease in homeless people since 2012. And that decrease was from 12,112 down to 11,199. That's a decrease of 913 people. But about 47% are living unsheltered. That means they're living in tents, in vehicles, or sleeping bare on the streets with maybe just a blanket or a sleeping bag or just their coat in a doorway, or, you know, under a bridge or something.
Or on a piece of cardboard.
or under a piece of cardboard, literally. Now, of that total unsheltered population, 68%, or more than two-thirds, are inside the Seattle city limits. So a lot of the folks who are sleeping unsheltered are the responsibility of the city of Seattle. But, of course, there were problems with this year's count. It's a single-night snapshot of people in shelters and sleeping outdoors. It doesn't capture the increasing numbers of people who are cycling through homelessness in the county throughout the year. And King County keeps other statistics about that, and those statistics are showing that an increasing number of people are cycling through the homeless system. So they're temporarily homeless for a few months, and then they're rehoused, and then they fall out of their housing again, et cetera. The count came under criticism by a lot of homeless shelter providers who are saying that they think the count was mismanaged and severely undercounted the homeless this year, because they're seeing packed shelters every single night, which is not something that they used to see. They're seeing what they feel is a much higher volume of the homeless in 2019 than in prior years. Now, the biggest decreases in the count were the counts of young adults, veterans, and families with children. Those are the three groups who saw the biggest increases over the past year in city and county spending on programs to target their needs and to get them off the streets. But even those programs are problematic. For example, service providers are saying that a lot of young white adults have been housed, but minority youth are not benefiting equally from these programs. And in the overall count of homeless people, the majority of are people of color. For example, African Americans make up more than 32% of folks counted in the one-night count, while only 6.2% of the county's total population is African American. And that 32% that are African American among the homeless population, that is an 8% increase from last year's count. So the numbers of people of color who are becoming homeless are not decreasing, at all. And if anything, maybe increasing. 10% of the homeless are Native American, while they make up only about half of 1% of the county's total population. So there's a big difference there. And another 15% of the homeless population is Hispanic or Latino, compared to just 10% of the population countywide. So that's a big issue, is the delivery of homeless services to the homeless population, and the delivery of shelter and housing services are targeting usually white folks and folks that service providers feel comfortable handling and feel are the easiest to get into housing. The services are not targeting folks, people of color, people who it may be more difficult to find housing for them because of their ethnicity, because landlords may be less likely to rent to a person of color versus a white person. And the city needs to find some way to address that, really. Also, with the one night count, while 36% fewer people were living in cars or RVs, 32% more people were living in tents or unsanctioned encampments. And this possibly points to a trend in which more homeless people are losing their last major asset, their car or their RV, and being forced to live in a tent or unsheltered under a blanket or something instead. Now, this would coincide with a crackdown by the city on ticketing and towing people's vehicles if they're parked too long in one place. It also coincides with the mayor having made a key decision early in the year not to open up a parking lot where folks could park if they're living out of their cars or their RVs. Although Durkin had really considered not allowing RVs in that lot. So that would have maybe helped folks who were living out of cars, but not people living out of RVs. I should also point out, too, that the overall decrease in the homeless is not countywide. Another troubling trend is a drop in homeless people in Seattle, but an increase in homeless people in East and Northeast King County. In other words, Durkin's sweep policy may be pushing homeless people outside of the Seattle city limits to the east side and to the suburbs. Now, in addition to a decrease in people living in RVs and cars, the other big decrease was a decrease of about 301 people living in transitional housing, which is meant to be a pipeline into permanent housing from emergency shelters into permanent housing, while people living in emergency shelters increased by 480. This points to another really disturbing trend, or perhaps combination of trends. We're not moving enough people into transitional housing while the demand for it is growing, because people in emergency shelter really need to move up the ladder into permanent housing, and transitional housing is the way to get there. Also, we've already moved into permanent housing a lot of the folks who are easy to house for various reasons. And now we have to work harder to get the chronically homeless and those who have a mental illness, disability, et cetera, out of emergency shelters and out of tents. And finally, the increase in the emergency shelter population could be pointing to an increased number of people cycling through the system. They get rent vouchers for a limited period of time to help them pay exorbitant rent. But then once those rent vouchers end, they end up back on the street in an emergency shelter again. So that is another trend that the city really needs to look at and address, just as King County is starting to identify it and address it.
I did a quick perusal of the report because I had heard from several people that the number of people counting this year mm-hmm. was down, and I wanted to see what those numbers were. And I think I got it right, where it looked like the previous year of 2018 had 800 people out counting, and this year they had 752 people. So, and by my math, that's a 6% drop. So mm-hmm. that might account a little bit for
a little
some
bit
of
for the difference.
The number shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could. Now, I also want to talk a little bit, too, about the demographics of the folks who were counted in the one-night count, because this is part of the conversation of what do we do about the homeless, who are among the homeless. A lot of the folks who are living in their single-family homes in Seattle's neighborhoods tend to demonize the homeless and say they're all drug addicts, they're all criminals, et cetera. And if they're not all criminals. They should be treated as criminals, et cetera. I think it's important then to take a look at the demographics and say, who are these folks? Let's humanize them a little bit rather than demonize them and try to find some way to help them. First off, the number of folks living on the street with a medical condition is staggeringly high, 64%, almost two-thirds. Of the total homeless population, 36%, or well over one-third, have a mental health condition. Drug or alcohol addiction accounts for 32% of the total homeless population, and 23% have an obvious physical disability. About 37% reported that they're living with a disability that makes them unable to hold a steady job or take care of themselves day to day. That's over one-third of the homeless population. When asked what they needed in order to get off the street, 64% said rental vouchers would help the most. That points to a problem with affordable housing, right? 31% said that housing affordability was the primary cause of their unhoused status. 24% said a job loss. 15% said eviction. 8% said they couldn't afford a rental increase, which is pretty similar to the housing affordability issue. 6% were booted out by relatives or friends who either couldn't afford to have them stay with them or didn't want to have them stay with them any longer. And 2% suffered a foreclosure. Again, an issue of housing affordability. Now, outside of the 37% who are too disabled to work, 21% of the homeless have jobs and are working, while an additional 38% are looking for a steady job. The remaining 4% may be the children or retired folks who were counted in the survey. Because don't forget, retired folks have a much, much harder time finding work and probably shouldn't be working. And yet they can get kicked out of their homes. They can get priced out of their apartments very, very easily. They don't tend to survive very long on the streets, so the numbers are small, but there are some retired folks who were not taken care of. The count estimated that about 7% of the homeless may be undocumented immigrants. That's not as high a figure as many of the NIMBY neighborhood activists would have you think. So the question, I think, is what was Mayor Durkan's response to this? Her response, of course, is to step up the sweeps. On Friday, the same day as All Home released these statistics, Mayor Durkan announced that the navigation team is going to be expanding again for the second time within the past year. With last year's budget, Durkan's requested and received money to expand the team from 22 members to 30 members. Now she's hiring an additional 8 people to expand it to 38 members, and the navigation team will now be sweeping encampments on the weekends in addition to sweeping them on the weekdays. Now, Erica Barnett, at her blog, The Sea is for Crank, had a pretty good story this week. She pointed out that one of the criteria used by the navigation team to declare an encampment an obstruction and sweep it without notice to the residents is whether that encampment has a lot of trash around it. Barnett did a few calculations. She looked at the statistics there, and she looked also at what kind of trash was being picked up from around these encampments. And she looked at the city's own reports of this. That's where she got the information. And she found that each encampment dweller would have to have produced nearly a half a ton of garbage in 3 months. That's more than 5 times more than the average housed person in the city of Seattle produces. She noted that lots of the garbage appears to be opportunistic dumping by people who live in houses nearby, and particularly home renovators or developers who don't want to pay Seattle Public Utilities to pick up their big items. Instead, they dump them next to the nearest homeless encampment. Those big items include things like couches, bar stools, rugs, mattresses, appliances, generators, used propane tanks, countertops, toilets, old bathtubs, car parts, and old bicycles, none of which you would expect a person who is chronically homeless to have a need for or the ability to acquire in any case. So I thought that was a very interesting article and something that you hear a lot from neighborhood activists. Oh no, these homeless people create a lot of garbage, blah, blah, blah. What you're not hearing is, oh, well, a lot of that garbage is not coming from the homeless. It's coming from home renovators and from residents living nearby who just don't want to pay to have their old furniture and their old appliances and garbage picked up by Seattle Public Utilities. So they just dump it next to the nearest homeless encampment.
Well, I remember hearing from several people that we both know that work with some of the camps, having reported in the past, seeing cars pull up and then dumping things at the camps and then pulling away.
And sometimes they'll just dump their regular garbage.
Right.
If they have a lot of regular garbage because they're moving or they're just doing their spring cleaning. And that's disgusting. And it is not the fault of the folks who are living unhoused there.
It's also interesting that you had said that 6% were out on the streets because they were forced, they were booted from being at a friend's or relative's house.
And
that's one of the solutions that Durkin is proposing for that we need to focus more on is getting more homeless people to
live with family members. And that's another criticism of the one night count is that it doesn't count folks who have lost their apartments because they can't afford the rent anymore and are living back home with mom or living with friends and relatives. Those folks should be counted as homeless as well, even though they're couch surfing.
Yeah.
And couch surfing is not a solution to the homelessness issue. This report shows that, you know, eventually that the good graces of your relatives and your parents eventually comes to an end and you end up on the street.
Right. Anything else on that?
Let's move on.
All right. Well, it appears there's a new PAC that's been
created. A new political action committee has formed to raise big money to throw into the upcoming city council races. It's called People for Seattle, and its stated intent is to represent the moderate/progressive political wing in Seattle politics, but of course not too progressive. But let's look at who's involved with People for Seattle. Its two main founders are Tim Burgess. He's the former three-term city council member, former interim mayor after Ed Murray resigned and before Jenny Durkin was elected, and a former police officer back in the 1970s. He was one of the more conservative members of the Seattle City Council over the last 15 years. The other main founder is Taylor Hong, a former mortgage broker who owns a chain of Vietnamese restaurants in Seattle, and who also has founded a number of high-tech startups in Vietnam. She sits on the board for the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. She co-chairs Mayor Jenny Durkin's Small Business Advisory Council and also founded the Ethnic Business Coalition, a 501c3 nonprofit that advocates for minority-owned businesses in Washington state. In other words, she is super connected in the business community. Other early supporters of the PAC include Tom Ahlberg. In fact, his name has been highly promoted in order to draw money into the PAC. He's the managing director of the venture capital fund Madrona Venture Group and sits on the boards of Impinj and Amazon. He was also the executive director of Macaw Cellular. And before that, he was an attorney at Perkins Coie, where he did legal work for Boeing, Alaska Airlines, and a lot of tech startups. Madrona Venture Group invests primarily in tech startups, and he has been doing that since 1995. So I would venture to say that Tom Ahlberg and Madrona Ventures has had an influential role, if not an outsized role, in building Seattle into a high-tech city.
He's also on the board of Challenge Seattle, mm-hmm. an organization dedicated to addressing the region's affordable housing crisis. How that's going for him.
Yeah, I do too. Another person who's involved is Joe Fugere, who owns Tutabella restaurant chain. He's representing the large big business restaurant owners in the city. There's David Stewart, former executive vice president and general counsel of Vulcan Inc., where he directed their legal office and their communications and media work, as well as overseeing their properties in Africa. He's also a former vice president of Real Networks, which is a tech company that develops online streaming tools and has been invested in a lot of online gaming recently. Also, Jordan Royer, the vice president for government affairs for the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, and is also a board member of the Manufacturing Industrial Council. Before that, Jordan Royer worked for two former mayors, Paul Schell and Greg Nichols, as a public safety advisor, creating the controversial Nightlife Task Force, which was heavily criticized for clamping down on bars and clubs in Seattle in the aughts. And he ran unsuccessfully for city council in 2010. He's also the son of former Mayor Charles Royer and a former op-ed writer for the Seattle Times. Also, Chris Bailey is heavily involved in People for Seattle. He's former King County prosecuting attorney and a member of the not-so-nutty wing of the Washington State Republican Party. He ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate in 1998 and didn't make it past the primary. His main claim to progressive politics is that he's a co-founder and chair of Stewardship Partners, formerly named the Resource Action Council, a 501c3 nonprofit which is involved in habitat restoration projects and educating people to, quote, work with nature, not against it, end quote. So definitely one of the folks who likes to restore nature in order because of its value to business. So this is really meant to be a sort of second Chamber of Commerce pack that masquerades as a progressive group.
Oh, there was a couple that you have
that I missed.
Okay, Mike, go ahead. If I may add to them. There's also, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, Lynn Tangen.
Who is
listed on their website as a downtown resident community volunteer, but is also happens to be the director of government and community relations at Vulcan.
Yes. She's a key Vulcan player.
And Paula Reynolds, who is, again, listed on their website as a trustee with the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, which is true, but she also happens to be on the board of directors of General Electric, British Petroleum, BAE, which is a weapons manufacturing firm, and TransCanada.
Oh, yeah, the pipeline builder.
Yeah.
So this is really a second Chamber of Commerce pack, a pro-business pack, but they're masquerading as a progressive group. Burgess and Hong have both said that their target is to take donations mostly from individuals and small businesses. However, it appears that most of the support has been coming from large businesses and people who are involved with large businesses and sit on their boards. In their first 5 days, People for Seattle raised $120,000, which puts them in the same league as CASE, the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy. That's the Seattle Chamber of Commerce's main business pack. CASE has raised almost $500,000 so far in this election cycle, with $200,000 of that coming directly from Amazon. So don't be fooled by a so-called progressive PAC that's actually representing big businesses in Seattle's high-tech industry. Donate directly to the candidates you support, and more importantly, volunteer on their behalf.
And also when Joel Conley wrote about this in the PI this week, and he said that this new group has absolutely nothing, no connection to CASE. Which, if you look at it, just simply is not true. There's numerous crossovers.
There's a lot of crossover there. So, yeah. All right. Yeah. The difference is they're not actively soliciting money directly from businesses, as CASE does. They're soliciting money from the executives who run those businesses. That's the difference here. And it's not a big enough difference to matter.
All right. Well, continuing your rundowns of candidates in different districts.
This week is District 3, the city council candidates for District 3. District 3 covers Capitol Hill, First Hill, the Central District, Yesler, Madison Park, Little Saigon, which is part of the International District, but just to the east of what we used to think of as the old International District, and North Beacon Hill. Now, the incumbent here is Shama Sawant. She's a member of the Socialist Alternative Party, is very upfront about that. Sawant was instrumental in getting the $15 an hour minimum wage passed, also the paid sick and safe leave law, and tenant protections. Her most recent issues have been saving the Showbox Theater downtown, preserving the Halcyon Mobile Home Park, and working on behalf of mobile home park residents in general, and adding more money for affordable housing and tenant protections into the city budget late last year. She also launched a new effort to legalize rent control in Seattle and eventually Washington State, and that's what she's working on a lot right now. And of course, that's rent control for both residential housing and for commercial properties, particularly on behalf of small and legacy businesses. And she also wants to expand public housing instead of decreasing it, as the Seattle Housing Authority has been doing. To fund that, she wants to work on another tax on big businesses, similar to the employee hours tax, which the city council passed unanimously last year, and then a month later defeated it and reversed itself. Sawant and Teresa Mosqueda were the only two council members to vote for the employee hours tax in the second vote that overturned it. She's the only one in the District 3 race who's not taking democracy vouchers because she doesn't want the donation limits that go with them. That's $350 per person instead of the $500 that she can take if she doesn't accept democracy vouchers. And she's expecting at least one challenger will get tons of funding from the business community, from Case and or other businesses. She's currently raised a little over $100,000. She gets a lot of flack for taking out-of-town donations from socialists in other U.S. cities, but she's still collecting a lot of small cash contributions from fundraisers that are being held in her district, probably more than any other candidate that I've seen in any of the district races so far. Now, her main challenger, the one who's raised the most money so far, maybe not her main challenger, but the one who's raised the most money so far, is Logan Bowers. He's a co-owner of Hashtag, which is a pot shop in Fremont. His three core issues appear to be housing, homelessness, and transportation. His ideas on housing include doing away with all areas zoned for single-family housing in Seattle, allowing triplexes to be built in single-family housing zones, and changing the zoning laws to include SROs. Those are single resident occupancy units, or what we think of as boarding houses, places where there are, say, for example, on your floor, there are lots of bedrooms, there's one kitchen, and there's maybe one or two bathrooms that all the residents on that floor share. That's what an SRO or boarding house is like. He would also like to expand commercial zones into the heart of residential neighborhoods so that grocery stores and other businesses can be built right next to housing. He is very much against rent control. His campaign has mostly consisted of red-baiting attacks against incumbent Shama Sawant. He filled out an ethics complaint and filed it against her in March, saying that she was turning over her decision-making to the leadership of the Socialist Alternative Party, including decisions on how she votes in city council meetings. Of course, there's really no way to prove that. And politicians usually have some kind of party support behind them, and they owe allegiance to some kind of party platform. And very seldom do you see rival political candidates call each other, for example, a Republican robot or a doorstop for the Democratic Party. It's just assumed that, yes, they're going to reflect the platform of their party. And because candidates assume that voters understand that when they're voting for them, so they tend to be pretty upfront about their party affiliation. And Sawant has definitely been upfront about her affiliation with the Socialist Alternative Party. Bowers has collected about $82,230 so far. A little over half of that are democracy vouchers. He's also contributed about $856 of his own money. His biggest donors are a pretty weird combination of high-tech people and marijuana retailers. Now, the third candidate in that race is Pat Murakami. She's a business owner and a mainstream Democrat who ran against Lorena Gonzalez in 2017 for the at-large city council position, won, and lost pretty badly there. She opposes all upzones of single-family neighborhoods, period. She opposes triplex, row houses, townhouses, and accessory dwelling units. That's backyard cottages and mother-in-law apartments in single-family neighborhoods. She wants to house Seattle's 12,000 or so homeless people in a single indoor campus with hygiene facilities and services, but she has not figured out a way to pay for it. She has suggested that the city council could use an old cruise ship for that purpose, which would lead to an environmental nightmare in Puget Sound, not to mention skyrocketing maintenance and logistics costs for running that thing. Notably, Murakami was instrumental in scuttling plans to put a parking lot near Genesee Park for homeless people who are living out of their cars. She worked with the Durkin administration to get that plan scuttled. As for transportation, she supports separated bike lanes but doesn't want to allow bikes on streets with cars, which is currently something that is absolutely unavoidable if you ride your bike around town in Seattle right now. She's mentioned no new funding sources or even an audit of SDOT, the Seattle Department of Transportation, to get them moving on building out the bike lane network or even looking at funding for transportation projects in general, which I think is a really important issue that needs to be tackled by the city council. Murakami has raised $62,655, and almost 80% of that are democracy vouchers. She's also contributed $6,110 of her own money, which means that her straight up cash donations are only about $7,000. And a lot of those are very small amounts. So she's been shaking a lot of hands and holding fundraisers too in her district. It has been mostly appealing to the more conservative members of her district and the folks who don't want to see upzoning of their single family housing areas. She has a lot of support from mainstream pro-business Democrats as well. Now, the fourth candidate in that race is Egan O'Ryan. He's a gay pride activist with PrideFest who played a key role in moving the main gay pride march from Capitol Hill to downtown. He's also a director with the Capitol Hill Chamber of Commerce and works with the Broadway Business Improvement District. So he is the pro-business. He is very much a pro-business candidate in this race. He's for duplexes, triplexes, and accessory dwelling units in Seattle's single-family housing zones. He's for building supportive housing for the chronically homeless by using city and county bonding capacity. That's, in other words, that's long-term loans. The city taking out long-term loans to build housing. But by his own calculation, this is only going to house maybe 2,000 people, not the over 11,000 to 12,000 people in the city of Seattle who actually need it. He also appears to favor private developers on these projects versus nonprofit developers. On transportation, he's for bike lanes and e-scooters and vague things like faster transit and electrifying the transportation system without going into details about what that would entail. He also likes to imply that Sawan is a socialist puppet. And he talks a lot about how she has demonized Amazon and other tech companies. He also thinks that the city council is fiscally irresponsible, which is a very typical pro-business refrain. O'Ryan has raised $25,845. About 43% of that are democracy vouchers. He's also contributed $175 of his own money. Among his biggest donors are lots and lots and lots and lots of Amazon employees. And Tim Sice, who is a former deputy mayor of Seattle from 2002 to 2010, and who played a key role in turning South Lake Union into a high-tech hell and in replacing the Alaskan Way Viaduct with a downtown traffic tunnel that's going to be underwater in about 20 years' time.
And is also involved doing the legal work for the PAC we were just talking about.
Yeah, PAC we were just talking about, the People for Seattle, the Rich People for Seattle. By the way, Tim Sice's business partner, Ryan Bain, also gave Egan O'Ryan the maximum contribution. Bain is a person who should be getting a little more attention, too, because he was a lobbyist and former director of intergovernmental relations for the Downtown Seattle Association. And his current job is to lobby local governments on behalf of Amazon, Vulcan, AT&T, the American Beverage Association, and other major corporate clients, including a lot of real estate developers. He's a major contender, I would say. Egan O'Ryan is a major contender for PAC money in this race from Case and from this new Rich People for Seattle PAC. Now, the fifth candidate, number five, in the race is Amy Nguyen. She's a public defender. She supports tenants' rights and affordable housing, affordable child care, and services to help minority and women-owned businesses. She supports the police reform process and diversion programs that provide treatment instead of incarceration. She's also very good on court reforms. She can be pretty hazy, though, on the details for some of these issues and very short on the practical, real solutions that would get any of them done. It's partly because she's very young and she's also really new to Seattle politics. She has said that she would support a capital gains tax to fund these initiatives, but again, she seemed unclear about the fact that the city council has already passed a capital gains tax that's currently tied up in court. Nguyen has raised about $17,897, and none of that was in democracy vouchers, even though she does qualify for them. A fair number of her contributors are from out of state, especially California, and that's because, as I said, she's a newcomer to Seattle, having just moved here from Los Angeles in 2016. That's probably, I think, the main reason she's really hazy on the issues and not a top contender in this race. Number six is, surprisingly, Zachary DeWolf. He has done a lot of nonprofit and volunteer work for groups like Trans Pride, the Gender Justice League, Capitol Hill Community Council, the Seattle Housing Authority Board, the South Seattle Emerald Community Advisory Board, and a lot of other groups. He was elected in 2017 to the Seattle School Board. He's currently a Seattle School Board member. And his current paying job is program manager with All Home King County. That's the agency we just talked about who released the one-night count of the homeless in King County. At All Home, he works on youth student homelessness programs. He has also experienced homelessness himself, and he's actually very, very good on this issue of housing youth who are living on the streets. But he's hazy and not as good on all of the other issues that the city council is working on, including affordable housing. For example, he cites the Yesler Terrace development as a good example of affordable housing in Seattle, but the Yesler Terrace redevelopment plan has displaced a huge number of very low-income families and sold that public land to private developers who have built mostly workforce housing. That's housing for people who make between 80% and 120% of median income.
Like Vulcan.
Yes, like Vulcan was one of the first developers involved with the Yesler Terrace redevelopment project. Previously, that land had housed people whose incomes were much, much lower than that 80% of median income. Now, DeWolf's a little bit better on homelessness issues than on housing, probably because he works on those issues in his day job. He wants to double the city's spending on homelessness, but he's a little hazy on how to pay for that, although he has suggested a payroll tax, which I assume means taxing business owners on gross payroll, not taxing their employees. But again, this would run into the same opposition as the employee hours tax, especially if you ask larger businesses to pay more in a progressive way, as he suggested he would do. He also suggested that the city levy an estate tax, which proves that he doesn't know much about tax policy, because the estate tax is very easy to dodge by rich people. And most rich people do dodge it by setting up trusts, writing wills, and, you know, setting up family LLC or two. So, like I say, he doesn't know that much about tax policy. He supports shallow rent subsidies. That's small monthly amounts that the city would give to low-income people to help with their rent. But again, without a plan to raise revenue and to make those long-term, that proposal is just a nice idea. It's not going to be helpful for keeping people long-term in their homes. Other than homeless services, he seems to know very little about the other issues that come before the city council. My biggest concern with him is that he seldom stays in one position for very long. Each job seems to be a rung in the ladder to somewhere else. And he is very, very charismatic and very good at shaking hands and playing the political candidate game and at drawing support behind his latest ambitious initiative. He's wrangled the endorsements of council members Teresa Mosqueda and Lorena Gonzalez in this race, and he's also received endorsements from all of the other six members of the Seattle School Board in this race. He's only raised, though, $16,857 in contributions. About 47% of those are democracy vouchers, and he's contributed about $100 of his own money. So we're going to have to see how these candidates do in raising money, who will get the PAC money from the Seattle Chamber of Commerce and Amazon and from this new Rich People for Seattle PAC. I have no doubt that those two groups will target this district for large donations to try to overturn Sewan. So we're going to see how that plays out as we get closer to the primary in August.
Oh, yeah. And still plenty of time for other PACs to be created. And
for more money to flow in.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of money flowing. I have no doubt in this city. Mm-hmm. All right. Sticking with the elections and candidates, you went to a forum this week.
I did, and I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about the limitations of candidate forums. First off, I want to thank everyone who's hosting a candidate forum. They really do take a lot of work, not just in calling and emailing the candidates and trying to coordinate a time when you can get the maximum number of them there, but things like renting a room, finding a good moderator, which is not easy, finding a date and time where the maximum number of people can attend, publicizing the event, coming up with good questions. It's all really hard. That said, it's really difficult to evaluate candidates in races with more than three or four people. Almost no one can summarize their policy on homelessness, for example, in 60 seconds, which is the time that they're given when you have more than six candidates. And most of our city council races now have more than six candidates in them. And I know that I have a tough time summarizing things in 60 seconds, and I don't really expect city council candidates to be able to do that either. So I think it's really important in these candidate forums to get a moderator who can come up with questions that candidates can answer in 60 seconds that are very revealing about how much they know about city politics, about how the city council operates and the issues that are vital, not just citywide, but in their districts as well. And that's proving to be pretty tough, at least in the council candidate forum I went to. The questions didn't really allow, weren't really geared towards the forum, towards the fact that the candidates could only answer in 60 seconds. For example, in this week, one of the questions was in the District 7 race that I went to, and District 7 covers downtown, Belltown, South Lake Union, Lower Queen Anne, Queen Anne Hill, and Magnolia. One of the questions was, do you support replacing the Magnolia Bridge? You know, and there's nobody in District 7 who's going to run to represent District 7 who is going to say, no, let's not replace the bridge. Let's let it fall down in the next earthquake and kill a lot of people. I mean, so you know, that was a bad question. A better question would have been, you know, given that we have to replace the Magnolia Bridge, what plan do you support for that and how are we going to pay for it? You know, and that's a question that would very quickly weed out the people who don't know anything about city politics or about transportation planning, who would, you know, sputter a lot and say, well, it has to be replaced. Oh, yeah, it needs to be replaced. Yes, it needs to be replaced, blah, blah, blah. And you could say, okay, that person doesn't know anything about this project and isn't really familiar with the district. From the people who would say, yes, it needs to be replaced, I support a direct replacement route of the current bridge, or I support this other alignment. It's going to cost X amount, or it's going to cost a lot of money at the very least. And this is how you get that money. You get some from the federal government, you get some from the state, and you look at maybe tolling, or you look at other local sources for that money. Some of that money might be able to come out of the MOVE Seattle levy, some might not. You know, and that's a good answer. And that's an answer that can be done in 60 seconds, you know, instead of asking this very hazy, should it not be replaced? I was getting pretty frustrated with the District 7 candidate forum. So I scribbled down towards the end, I scribbled down a question that I thought would separate the wheat from the chaff. And my question was, if you're elected to the city council, what committee would you like to chair and why? And I just kind of gave it to the guy who was collecting questions, thinking, you know, maybe it'll get asked or maybe it won't. And it was actually the last question asked at the forum. And it did that job of weeding out the people who don't know anything about the city council, because immediately there were two candidates who knew nothing about city council, how the city council operates, who eliminated themselves by kind of sputtering over that question. Another two candidates eliminated themselves for holding a personal grudge by saying, you know, we would want to sit on that committee that Deborah Juarez chairs that passed the waterfront improvement district that is now imposing a tax on people in the district to build the waterfront park. And that kind of made me laugh because, come on, people, the clue to what that committee is in the word you just said. It's the Parks Committee. I mean, I know it has a longer name, you know, and that it says public, and that it's now, you know, civic development, public assets, et cetera. But, you know, it's the Parks Committee, you know, and if you got a personal grudge against Deborah Juarez and the Parks Committee, that's going to cross you off my list right away, because clearly you're not in the room for any other real reason. You know, and then another candidate eliminated himself by repeating word for word what another candidate had said earlier, you know, and if you're not prepared enough and you're just going to crib off somebody else, then you're off my list. So there you go. Five of the nine candidates suddenly have proved themselves to be unelectable in that sense. And the remaining four, another one I crossed off my list because she said land use, and particularly because she didn't want her remaining single family zone at the top of Queen Anne Hill to be upzoned. That again is somebody with a grudge against the city. She got crossed off my list, narrowing it even further to four candidates, or narrowing it even further, eventually down to three candidates. Michael George, who talked about building affordable housing in a part of the district that is in Inner Bay, which is part of the district that's going to be underwater in 20 or 30 years with rising sea levels. That's where he wants to put affordable housing because, of course, the real estate developers that he represents and who have contributed heavily to his campaign would not want to build for-profit housing down and run for-profit apartment buildings down there because they'll lose those assets. So again, he was crossed off my list. That left two good candidates in that race, just with the one question, Andrew Lewis and Jim Pugel. Andrew Lewis, who said that, again, he's for sitting on a housing committee because he has an extensive plan for affordable housing citywide, but that he would also be interested in adding the arts to that committee because arts are a big issue in District 7, and they are because District 7 is downtown Belltown in Lower Queen Anne. And Jim Pugel, who stood up and said transportation and infrastructure, because the district, as well as the whole of Seattle, have grown massively in population. And we just have not invested in the right transportation solutions and the right infrastructure for that new influx of people. And I'm like, okay, those are the two candidates who know the district. Those are the two candidates who understand the citywide issues and whose politics align well with mine and who understand how the city council operates enough to pick actual real committees and know what they are and know what they do. So I thought that, you know, asking those pointed questions, going to a council candidate forum with one or two really good pointed questions that separate the wheat from the chaff will help you in figuring out who the good candidates are. But you have to also look at who is donating to their campaigns, and you need to do your homework outside of those as well.
Always.
Always.
All right. Got a little bit of time left for national. Louisiana joining the, what is it now,
yeah,
six or seven states?
The wave of southern states that have passed anti-abortion laws. Yeah, on Wednesday, the Louisiana state legislature passed a fetal heartbeat bill with 79 votes to 23, with more than a dozen Democrats supporting the bill, including its sponsor, Senator John Milkovich, who is a Democrat. The law bans abortions after an electrical pulse can be detected, which can be as early as 6 weeks. And I should point out that this is not not a real heartbeat, because a baby's heart isn't fully formed. The muscle of the baby's heart is not fully formed until about the 20th week, as current research has determined. The law makes no exceptions, of course, for cases of rape and incest. Louisiana Democrats are notoriously conservative when it comes to women's reproductive health. In 2006, the state legislature passed a bill, again sponsored by a Louisiana Democrat, to automatically ban all abortions in the event that the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. That state has also banned public financing for abortions and has passed other laws restricting abortions. There are only three clinics left in the entire state that provide that service. The new law won't go into effect right away because a similar law in Mississippi was blocked in federal court last Friday. So that also means that Louisiana's law, which is very, very similar to Mississippi's, won't go into effect until that court case is decided. Meanwhile, a judge in the state of Missouri blocked the state from closing down the only abortion clinic left in that state. Every year, the state of Missouri Health Department reviews the license renewal for the clinic run by Planned Parenthood in St. Louis, and it does a type of audit. This year, that audit got a lot tougher. The state asked for additional requirements. For example, it required the clinic to make the change of adding an additional pelvic examination for abortion patients, which is not medically necessary, but appears to be a way to abuse and intimidate women who are seeking abortions. Planned Parenthood agreed to that new requirement and the other changes, except for one. The state demanded that all seven doctors at the clinic submit to interviews by the state that could be referred for criminal investigations. Planned Parenthood refused and then sued in court. Those interviews and the doctors' answers to those interviews could, under the new law, mean that they would be referred for criminal prosecution, in other words. The Missouri Circuit Court Judge Michael Stelzer granted a temporary restraining order preventing the state of Missouri's attempt to revoke the clinic's license. A hearing in that case is going to be held next Tuesday. If the judge rules against Planned Parenthood, Missouri will become the first state in the U.S. to be completely without an abortion provider since Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973. Also this week, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear a case from Indiana that would ban abortions for reasons of the sex or disability of the fetus. This law was passed in 2016 and signed into law by then Governor of Indiana Mike Pence, who is now our vice president. The Supreme Court rejected hearing the case because there was no disagreement among the lower courts on the abortion part of the case. They had all agreed with Planned Parenthood and overturned the anti-abortion part of the law. The Supreme Court did, however, rule on the portion of the law that had caused disagreement in the lower courts. That's the requirement to bury or cremate fetal remains. The High Court upheld that requirement, leaving only that part of the law on the books. So that is our wrap-up of anti-abortion news in the United States this week. It's still very much an issue. Women and their male allies still need to get out in the streets and get working on this issue.
All right. Moving on to the Trump administration, further attacks on science.
Yeah. The New York Times reported this week that officials in the Trump administration are putting new limits on climate change science. James Riley, he's a former astronaut and oil geologist and is the current head of the U.S. Geological Survey. He's directing that agency to produce scientific reports using only computer-generated climate models through the year 2040 and not through the year 2100. Climate scientists all agree that the effects of global warming will accelerate with time, with the worst effects occurring after the year 2050. By not using science that goes past the year 2040, the Trump administration wants to promote climate models that are overly optimistic. And the Trump administration wants to eliminate any information from 2040 on from government reports. Where this is particularly bad is in the National Climate Assessment, which is produced every 4 years. The last report was released last year, and the Trump administration managed to delay its release until the slowest news day of the year, the Friday after Thanksgiving. Now they're trying to make sure that the next report won't be as comprehensive or as alarming as the previous reports. This is going to have a big impact, especially on legal cases. Currently, environmentalists are able to sue the federal government and use the government's own reports on the effects of global warming as evidence that the Trump administration's policies are wrongheaded and not based on scientific evidence. Without that information, it'll be much, much harder to win those cases. Environmentalists will have to rely on private studies that might not be as broad or as comprehensive as the bigger studies financed by the federal government. Some government agencies are resisting that directive, however. For example, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is responsible for predicting weather patterns in the United States, has said that it will make no changes to its climate models, and it is still going to be projecting those climate models out to the year 2100. So where it really matters day-to-day and where businesses care, like in predicting weather patterns and weather disasters, the Trump administration is making no changes, but it's making a lot of changes in other areas.
All right. And finally, do we have enough time to squeeze in the...
Yeah, the Supreme Court is going to soon be... has heard a case that seeks to prevent the U.S. Commerce Department from adding a question to the 2020 U.S. Census asking about citizenship status. Well, this week, new evidence was introduced in that case. Republican redistricting strategist Thomas Hofeller had helped create the question and also wrote several memos and legal briefs to undergird the argument that the Trump administration is making to include that citizenship question for the first time on the U.S. Census. Because immigrants and people of color tend to vote for Democrats, this would help Republicans when it comes to redrawing legislative districts. Hofeller is a gerrymandering strategist, and he had hoped that by including a question about citizenship on the census, that then a lot of immigrants would choose not to fill out the survey, that that would help Republicans in those districts and make it a lot easier for them to redraw districts to help them in the electoral system and get more Republicans elected in national as well as local races. Now, the lawyers suing to prevent the citizenship question also say they have evidence that the Trump administration tried to hide Hofeller's role in writing the question and writing the legal briefs that supported including it in the census. This contradicts sworn testimony by several Trump administration officials. The ACLU has filed a motion in court on Thursday. They filed it on Thursday to sanction any Trump administration officials who gave untruthful testimony in the case. There'll be a hearing next week in the U.S. District Court on that issue. The case has already been argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, and currently the Supreme Court is writing up their opinion on that case. So I don't know that this new evidence is going to influence them at all. We'll just have to wait and see.
All right. Events.
Events. Yes, this week is Honkfest West. If you love a good funky brass band, this is for you. It runs from Friday to Sunday at various locations in the South End. Today, it's going to be at Southwest Roxbury and 16th Avenue Southwest in White Center. And tomorrow, bands will be playing at Columbia Park. That's behind the PCC at South Edmund Street and Rainier Avenue South. For more info, you can go to www.honkfestwest.org. The Seattle International Film Festival is also running through June 9th at various locations around town. You can check out their great list of documentary and international films at www.siff.net. Today, June 1st, is Lilo's 2019 dinner in honor of Silmé Domingo, Jean Viernes, and Milton Jefferson. Lilo stands for Legacy of Equality and Leadership and of Equality, Leadership, and Organizing. They were founded in the early 1970s to empower low-income workers of color, immigrants, and women to organize for their rights. This is their annual fundraising dinner. Tickets are $80. It runs from 5:30 to 9:30 at the Filipino Community of Seattle, 5740 Martin Luther King Way, Jr. South. You can purchase tickets at squareup.com. Sunday, June 2nd, that's tomorrow, is National Animal Rights Day in Seattle with music speakers and lots of local organizations tabling. This is an international event held every year on the first Sunday in June to honor our allies of a different species. That's at noon in Westlake Park at 4th and Pine downtown.
And bring an animal.
And bring an animal, yeah. Monday, June 3rd is Defending Science from Denial and Fraud. That's a discussion with Lee McIntyre, a research fellow at Boston University. That's from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at Town Hall at 8th and Seneca Street. Thursday, June 6th is the Green New Deal Town Hall, hosted by Got Green and Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien. Space is prioritized for people of color and families of color. That's from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ethiopian Community in Seattle at 8323 Rainier Avenue South. And Friday, June 7th, is the film Dammed to Extinction, which looks at the impact of dams on salmon and the orca who depend on them. That's followed by a discussion with the filmmaker. The reception is from 5:30 to 6:30, followed by the film from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Mountaineers at 7700 Sandpoint Way Northeast. And then next Saturday, June 8th, at the Resiliency Space, Resiliency Space, a trans health fair to empower trans and non-binary folks to take control of their health. There will be speakers from QueerDoc.com, the Gender Justice League, Lambda Legal, and others. That starts at 11 a.m. at the MLK Fame Community Center at 3201 East Republican Street on Capitol Hill.
And speaking of whales and salmon, J-Pod had a baby this week.
Had a baby this week, yeah. Yes, for the first time.
So fingers crossed that
that baby survives.
Yeah, that we haven't polluted things and depleted the food supply so badly that the baby doesn't make it like the last
J-Pod,
one.
Yeah, that J-Pod baby. Hopefully J-Pod baby will survive and become a J-Pod orca.
A J-Pod adult.
Yes, yes.
All right.
We're hoping and praying for that.